Democratic presidential candidate and founder of Next Gen America, Tom Steyer, joined us for Civil Liberties in the Presidency. This event was presented by the Warren B. Rudman Center for Justice Leadership and Public Service and the American Civil Liberties Union of New Hampshire.
Welcome to the Rudman Center podcast. Learn more about the Warren B. Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service at law.unh.edu/Rudman. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.
I mean, I'm running for a very simple reason, and I think I was the last person to get into the race. And I'm really running because I think the government has been broken. I think it's been broken for a simple reason, which is that corporations have bought it. And when I heard the debates talking about which healthcare plan was the best, which education plan was the best, which Green New Deal was the best, which gun violence program was the best, I didn't feel like they were talking the truth, which is, how are we going to get any of those things to happen? You know, those are all problems that have beset the United States specifically for decades and where there has been no answer. And the reason there's been no answer is because it's working just perfectly for the corporations who run our country. And so if we don't have for 28 years any governmental response to climate crisis, it's perfect for the oil and gas companies. And if we have had decades of gun violence at a level that is unparalleled, it's perfect for the gun manufacturing companies. And if we pay twice as much for healthcare as any other country in the world, that works well for drug companies, it works well for insurance companies, it works well for monopoly hospitals, just doesn't work well for the people of the United States. And I felt like until we start talking about what's really going on in the United States, that it's not a question of which program is better. There are huge differences, it does matter, I do have strong opinions. But the first question we have to ask ourselves is, how are we going to get any of these things passed? And you know, to me, this is all about, and this is a perfect question for the ACLU, how do we get back to government of, by, and for the people? That's really the question, because if we get back to that, we're going to get everything else that we want. We can argue around the edges about which program is better within the choices, but we are going to get healthcare as a right. We're going to get the education system from pre-K through college that young people deserve. We're going to get a living wage for every American so that one job is enough. And we're going to get the right to clean air and clean water in the context of climate so that no one gets to poison you and your family so they can be richer. But the question is, how are we going to get the government that will deliver that in the first place? So let me talk to you a little bit about what I've been doing about that over the last 10 years. First of all, I would say for the last 10 years, I've been organizing coalitions of ordinary American citizens to take on unchecked corporate power. And so what does that look like? In 26 states, you're allowed to run propositions where people get to pass laws. So in that context, I've taken on oil companies and beaten them, which no one thought was possible because they have unlimited money and will do whatever it takes, supposedly. I took on the tobacco companies, who had won 17 times in a row, got a $3 to $4 billion a year tax, and gave it to Medi-Cal, which is the healthcare program for the lowest income Californians. I've taken on monopoly utilities, drug companies, and I've also done something, which is to start one of the biggest grassroots organizations in the United States, called Next Gen America. This is also particularly relevant both to the ACLU and to people from New Hampshire. We have been organizing in New Hampshire on campuses since the beginning of 2014. We were here for the last time that Jeanne Shaheen ran for the Senate. And we are on 19 campuses in New Hampshire. In 2018, we were organized by congressional districts, Next Gen America, including here. We chose 38 congressional districts. More than doubled the turnout of young people in those districts. The turnout from 2014 to 2018 of young people went from under 20% to over 40%. 33 of the 38 flipped. So we were here in Chris Pappas's district. You know, if you look at, I think there are a lot of people who might be able to say this, but if you look how close Maggie Hassan's race was, you know, we registered more people on UNH than she won by. So the other thing I'd say is this, we are aware from the standpoint of the American Civil Liberties Union that there's been an attempt by Republicans across the country to take away the rights of students who are from out of state to vote. Where I know that we've been fighting this when they originally passed the bill in the Senate, then we fought for the redress in the House, and we were opposed to the governor's veto. New Hampshire might be the worst on this, by the way. I mean, if you look around the country, taking away the rights of African Americans to vote systematically in an organized and effective fashion is something that goes on at huge scale. But this attempt now across the country to take away the rights of young people to vote, as has happened in New Hampshire, to basically charge them hundreds of dollars to get an in-state driver's license to try and prevent their voting, is something that's newer, less established, and is being fought in the courts right now. Let me talk for a second about what I've done in terms of incarceration. I'm sure you guys know we incarcerate people as a country at 7 times the rate of any other country in the world, which is a pretty amazing fact. In California, we worked, and I personally worked for 2 years to get rid of cash bail. We did get rid of cash bail last year, so that instead of it being a question of whether you can afford bail as whether you have to await sentencing in jail, now that's no longer true. I also worked, and it succeeded, in getting rid of automatic sentencing enhancements to give more discretion to judges, but particularly to get away from the idea that it's written into the law that if you have priors, that that automatically affects how you get sentenced going forward. If you look at, I mean, one of the things that I was reading about is, in the context of the ACLU, how are you going to reduce the prison population? And these are two of the four things, that those two areas, automatic sentencing and getting rid of cash bail, is about 3/4 of it takes to have the prison population. Just so you guys know, I don't know how much you follow that. I've also spent millions of my own dollars hiring lawyers to represent people in threat of being deported. So across the country, if you look and see people under threat of deportation, if they're not represented, if they don't understand their rights, and by definition, common sense says they may not be the most informed people about the laws of the United States. If they're unrepresented, they have a very low chance of being able to assert their rights. And we've worked really hard for several years, really since Trump came into office, to try and make sure that many more people have representation and to put in line online tools for lawyers to use so that they can access the information and representing their clients more effectively. We've been doing that really since Trump came in. And the last thing I'll say is this. You may not have noticed, but I started the Need to Impeach campaign, which is a straightforward attempt to hold a lawless president to account under the laws of the United States. And I think I understand the difference between criminality and impeachment, but there's a real question here about whether, and he clearly doesn't think he is, whether the president, there is any constraint on his power, whether he is supposed to obey any standard. In fact, it's quite clear that he doesn't, and it's his behavior from the first day of his presidency has been a flouting of the American Constitution. I personally greatly enjoyed his description of the Constitution as the phony emoluments clause. It's like, wow, you really did say it. And the last thing I'll say is this. The ACLU is about protecting the rights of individual Americans. That's really, I mean, I've thought about what is the context. That's really what it's about. And if you listen to me, I've spent a lot of time trying to stand up for what I think is right within the law, but in the context of just morality. But I'm also trying in this campaign to assert a different framework of rights for Americans in the 21st century. So to me, if you said, does an American have a right to healthcare, I would say yes. If you said to me, does an American have a right to clean air and clean water? I would say yes. If you said, does an American have a right to a quality public education? I would say yes. And if you ask me, does an American have a right to a living wage in the context of this society? I would also say yes. And I really want people, I honestly want to change the way people view the relationship of individuals to our society in that context. That in fact, we have rights that they couldn't have asserted when they wrote the Constitution, that in fact, I believe exist today and should be codified. But the first point is to change the framework of how people really think about rights and the relationship of a citizen to the government and to their fellow citizens. Last thing I'll say is this, which isn't about the ACLU. I think that we are going to have the biggest success politically in terms of progressivism in the history of America next year. I think people, for some reason, are scared to say that. But I think we're going to be able to have a turnout, just as I know that 2018 was about people showing up who hadn't showed up before. That, you know, we, in the places we were, the turnout for young people went from 18 to 41, more than a double. But the turnout overall for Democrats went from 35 million in 2014 to 59 million, up by more than two-thirds. We are going to have a turnout that's going to dwarf people's expectations, and it's going to dwarf anything we've ever seen before, for the very good reason that it's going to matter so much, and everybody's going to figure it out. So I actually think when you hear people in the Democratic Party talk about politics, they like to talk about the 2% in the middle, the swing voters who can't decide how they feel about civil liberties and freedom and justice. And I say, why don't you take a look at the 50% of Americans who don't vote, who may not be registered, but who don't show up at the polls. And let me say, we're huge. We registered 1.3 million people in 2016, Next Gen America. Look at that 50% and see what happens when they vote, because they're all progressives. Those are all people who are going to vote progressive if they show up at the polls. So it's not about the 2% who can't decide if Trump is a crook or not. It's about the 50% who can't decide whether America's system is worth a bean or not. And if they decide that it really matters for their future and the future of their families and communities, and they show up and vote, we are going to win absolutely everything in places that people can't imagine right now. And that is actually what I think is going to happen next year. Jeannie.
Thank you, Tom. So now we're going to open it up for questions. We're going to do a combination of questions that I get to ask and a combination of questions from the audience. But I will take the liberty of being the moderator to ask the first one. You raised the good point that there are a number of rights that need to exist now that the people who wrote the Constitution couldn't have imagined. And one of those is certainly the area of privacy. The Constitution was written before the age of Facebook, before the age of Google, before the age of big tech. And so they couldn't have comprehended the threats to privacy that we are now facing on a daily basis in America. So as president, how would you protect consumers from the invasion of privacy that is Facebook, Google, and big tech?
Well, I think there are a couple things going on in terms of privacy. And I think Jeannie may have thought about this more deeply than I have. But the two that I think about, one is how the companies are taking your data and selling it. And so the question there, to a big extent, as far as I'm concerned, is they do it just the way the mortgage crisis happened, which is they effectively get you to consent in a way that you don't really know what you're consenting to, and then you're hooked forever. And it's just like in mortgages, they say, you know, we didn't defraud anybody. Look, it's right there in footnote 7 on page 63. What are you talking about? You know, they agreed to that, knowing full well that, of course, no one really got to footnote 7 on page 63. So I think the first question has to do with what the companies are doing about invading you and trying to search as much as possible for your information so they can sell it. And that's something which seems to me to be a real question about consent and awareness. That if you know, and they may have to change their business model. fine. That's the way it goes. But the second one that I think is really scary is how much the government can know about us. And whether they have, you know, there's been this question all along, how much they can follow your phone calls, how much they can track you. You know, what can you actually, what is there anything about you that they can't know if they want to? And do you have any, do they have to have any rights the way you'd think of that we've had to in terms of getting a search warrant from a judge? And so to me, a real question is government control. And you say, well, and I think people tend to think, and I disagree with them, well, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, then why do you need privacy? And obviously the point about that is, if you have no privacy from the government and they can know everything you're doing, then the possibility of dissent goes away. You can have no ability to dissent from the government effectively if they don't choose to let you. And what you can see with governments and human beings in any time is they don't like dissent when it works. So as long as they feel like you're a harmless, inefficient, ineffective, meaningless group, maybe they'll allow you to dissent. But what we can see, including in America, is that when people are actually dissenting in a way that upsets the status quo, they always crack down. And so when you think about privacy, it's not just a question of, oh, if you're doing nothing wrong, then you don't need to worry about privacy. That's a complete bunch of baloney as far as I'm concerned. I don't like the idea of somebody in Washington, D.C. knowing everything about me and deciding what I'm going to get to do. And that's really the question in front of us.
So on that, because you mentioned California in your opening remarks, one thing that San Francisco has done is ban the use of facial recognition technology, which is the notion of you can't, if there's facial surveillance being used, you can't ever hide from it. Would you take the step of banning facial surveillance technology nationally?
I don't know exactly what the circumstances under which it would be okay. So I want to flip that on its head, Jeannie. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd like to hear the argument for when, you know, so in a lot of these things, you can get a court order to do something. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can go to a judge and say, you know, we need to go into this person, we have probable cause to go do a search. We have a probable cause to go put on a phone tap. We have and then you have some oversight that's not just the CIA, the FBI, the local cop deciding they don't, you know, for whatever reason they want to do it. There's oversight from the judicial system. And so that's my answer to a lot of these things is, look, if there's some oversight that says, yes, we need to do this, then I tend to think, okay, let's put that system in place and use it. It's the question of when it runs amok, which it inevitably does. You know, people always think, well, you know, they won't misuse it. Well, actually, they will. And that's really the way I break this down.
Let's start with questions from the audience. Somebody have a really good one.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for coming to New Hampshire.
And what's your name, sir?
My name's Dennis Jakubowski. We're from Loudoun over here. Thanks for coming to New Hampshire. Thank you for running. I have a real problem with the Customs and Border Patrol setting up roadblocks in the middle of my state. If my wife and I want to go for a hike up in the White Mountains, I don't want to be stopped 90 miles from the border and asked to prove who I am or detained. What do you think about these random Border Patrol stops all over the country?
So, Dennis, let's just go back, because not everybody is aware, I don't think, of what you're talking about. Maybe people in New Hampshire are more aware. Maybe you guys are more aware than the people in California are. But basically, what Dennis is referring to is that Customs and Border Patrol basically have the right to do search and seizure without any probable cause within 100 miles of a border, and the ocean is a border. So, you know, you think, oh, well, that would just be, you know, Canada and Mexico. No, Atlantic Ocean, Pacific Ocean, 100 miles, and they don't have to have probable cause, and they can detain you as well. So to me, we've gone to this place where we've basically suspended all of the normal protections and political rights of Americans within 100 miles of the border to this agency that they can do whatever they want. They can search you, they can search your car, they can detain you without having any reason, you know, any justification. And they've turned that detention into really long stays to boot. So what do I think about it? I think that we've panicked in terms of the way we do immigration, that we've basically suspended all the laws and rights of American citizens out of this political fear about being invaded. And I think that we've got to walk it back. There's no question in my mind.
Thank you. I'm going to follow up on that because you mentioned the 100-mile jurisdiction, which pretty much means all of New Hampshire fits within CBP's jurisdiction. So one of the things that has come up in other forums is whether presidential candidates would support reducing CBP's mileage jurisdiction. So rather than 100 miles, maybe moving it closer to an actual border, like 25 miles from the border, which at least you're in the vicinity of a border then. So as a presidential candidate, would you support reducing CBP's jurisdiction from 100 to 25 miles?
So the short answer to Jeannie's question is yes. But I don't think it really gets at Dennis's question, because there's a question here about the right of Customs and Border Patrol to suspend all the rights of Americans as long as it's within whatever their jurisdiction is judged to be. And so what you're saying is let's reduce the problem practically by 75%. The question is, Dennis is really asking a different question, which is how do we think about the fact that we've suspended the rights of American citizens to a police group, you know, in a somewhat arbitrary fashion, in a somewhat arbitrary place, and they're completely suspended. That's really the question, and that's, I really think, the question that needs to be addressed.
So one quick question based on how government works, because the issue has come up that a lot of the Democratic candidates have put forward policies that they can't do by themselves, that they would have to have congressional support to achieve, right, which means usually you're going to need some level of bipartisan support. So you and many other presidential candidates have committed to repealing the Hyde Amendment, which restricts access to abortion. To do that, you need congressional approval or congressional support. So as a presidential candidate, how would you secure bipartisan support for repealing the Hyde Amendment?
So let's talk for a second about how people are thinking. Jeannie's question is really about how are we going to meet in the middle with people who disagree with us and have not compromised with us one time in at least the last 15 years. Not one time. And so the question is, what have we done wrong that they wouldn't have met, you know, that they wouldn't have compromised with us? And the answer is nothing. I see this differently. When I'm a grassroots person, I don't believe that we're going to win an objective discussion with Republicans. I don't believe we've seen them respond to objective fact on any of these things, and particularly not on this. So when I talk about it, from my standpoint, I'm a grassroots person. I ended up by saying, I think we're going to have the biggest victory in American history next year. I also think we need to have the biggest victory in American history next year, because I think they're a rogue party. You know, I thought it was somewhere between amusing and shocking that they were complaining about the hearings, the impeachment inquiry hearings, that they didn't think they were done fairly. I mean, this is the party of Merrick Garland, Benghazi, you know, gerrymandering, voter suppression, allowing Russian hacking, and they don't think that the hearing was done right? Really? So when I think about this, the idea that somehow they're going to respond, particularly on this issue, to meeting in the middle, to objective fact, to, you know, some form of compromise, I find really, really unrealistic. I think there's something else going on here. We are actually going to have to win. And it's gotten to a point where not winning is unbearable. And that's why I started by saying it's unbearable in climate, literally going to be unbearable. But it's unbearable in terms of gun violence. It's unbearable in terms of where we are in terms of healthcare. It's unbearable. And so the real question to me is, are we going to go out and organize that 50% of Americans who don't vote because they think the system is broken into thinking that if they do vote, the system will unbreak itself? because I don't believe, having watched really President Obama go 0 for 8 years in terms of reaching a compromise on anything, that we have a party that's prepared to compromise with us on the other side. And so, you know, that's my answer. We have to go in a completely different way. And if that happens, then I think they'll be willing to compromise. But not until the American people insist on it. And so I think the idea, this is not subject to objective argument. This is subject to political action. And if we don't do the political action, we're not going to get the objective argument. And I think that's the truth of what's going on.
I'm going to push you a little bit, because every president, whether in their first 2 years or their latter 2 years, has faced a Congress that has at least one chamber empowered by the other party. So at some point during a 4-year tenure, there's going to have to be some level of bipartisan cooperation or nothing's going to get done.
I agree. And so let me give you an example, Gene, of what I think. And let's talk about impeachment for a second. So I started Need to Impeach over 2 years ago, October 20, 2017. People said, can't happen. No, you're ridiculous. In fact, you're going to screw us up for the 2018 election. We said, no, actually, 8.3 million people have ended up signing it. We didn't screw up the 2018 election. We were a big addition to the 2018 election. But people say now, oh, you can get them impeached, but they'll never vote to remove them. And I say, no, that's not true. If you put the hearings on TV and let the people in New Hampshire see what's going on and hear the evidence for themselves, like Brett Kavanaugh, like Michael Cohen, the American people will make up their mind, and then the Republicans will have to do what their constituents want, or they'll get thrown out of action, out of office. So to a very large extent, that's what I believe in. That my whole goal in this is not to go to congressional or senatorial Republicans. My goal in this is always to go to the American people, because that's the only thing they're listening to. The minute those Senate Republicans think they're going to get voted out of office, if they don't get rid of the president, he's gone. They don't like him. They know that everything that we've been saying in Need to Impeach is true. They know it better than we do. But they're just worried about their jobs. So the only thing they're going to listen to is what their constituents insist on. And so as far as I'm concerned, that's the only way they're going to move. Not because, look, take climate. There's no other side to the climate argument objectively. No one goes into public and argues the other side. It's just political. And that's why we have to respond politically.
Questions?
Hi, thanks for being here. So I think America. Oh, my name's Jeremy.
Jeremy.
Live in Manchester.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So I think Americans have a right to not live in fear. And something that particularly frightens me right now is the threat of nuclear proliferation. There's currently a bill in both the Senate and the House that would force the United States to officially adopt a no first use policy for nuclear weapons. We're a laggard on this, and I don't think many people realize that. China adopted a no first use policy in 1964. India also has one in place. So I'm curious, as president, what your position would be on no first use.
So Jeremy, I take your point that, you know, there are some things hanging over our heads that could change everybody's lives without any of us being able to do anything. It's very scary. And it's particularly scary if you have a president who doesn't believe in alliances, treaties, partners, or any kind of value-based decision making. It's very scary. And so what you're asking, from my point of view, fits into a much broader context of how we're acting in the world. Shouldn't we be doing, and I think President Obama did this really well, of saying we're a value-driven society with traditional allies who we support and who support us, and together we provide kind of a rubric for the world that makes us much safer and more prosperous. And that's, you know, shouldn't we be agreeing to things together that push us forward in a good way and take some of the biggest risks off the table, as opposed to withdrawing from nuclear arms treaties and basically saying to every country of the world, we don't trust you, you can't trust us, It's just somewhere between a competition and a confrontation, and if we can, we're going to kick you in the face. So yeah, of course I'm for that. I mean, I believe if you look at Paris, if you look at what happened in the Iran treaty, that actually we have to, the problems in the United States do not begin and end inside our borders. This is a perfect example. We can only solve that problem by working with other people collaboratively and making agreements and being a trustworthy person. That we don't walk away from our word, that we do support our allies, that when we take on a mission, we are open about it and we pursue it openly, but consistently. So yeah, of course I would do that. But it fits into this much broader concept of how America acts in the world and how we lead in the world. And look, I'll just put this in. We aren't solving climate within the borders of the United States. If we don't do just this kind of thing, it can't be solved. And it takes American leadership on that. Thank
you. Other questions? We'll move over here.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah.
Sarah.
I have a brief three-part question for you.
Scary.
So given that 1 in 5 Americans are living with a disability, and that amounts to about 19% of likely voters, what have you done to employ people with disabilities in your campaign, make your campaign events accessible? And if elected, what will you do in your administration to continue to ensure employment for people with disabilities?
So obviously the point that you're making, Sarah, is a basic one. How do we ensure that people with disabilities can participate fully in society? Knowing that we'll have to act, we'll have to take, we can't be passive about it, we have to actively include, make steps so that they can do it. And so that's a question of how do we make sure that at every event there's accessibility, that in hiring we make it possible for people to be included. It's a broad category. And it really, and let me say this too, I don't know how the 1 in 5 is measured, and I don't know what it has to do specifically with mental health, but I think the question in the United States increasingly is, how do we include people and care for them and make it possible for them to reach their capabilities, knowing that they may have issues from before for whatever reason that have to be actively addressed so that they can pursue that. And I think that that is something which has got to be, I think it really comes into some combination of justice and health. And so it's a question of putting resources towards it, you know, as a society. But it's also a question of a different attitude in terms of how we think about people being, and I having different capabilities and needing support in certain ways. So from a standpoint of hiring, you know, we of course we take that into consideration, and we do. You know, California is very aggressive. I'm from California, in terms of making sure that people with disabilities have rights and are taken care of in terms of hiring, but also in terms of their access to everything. But I think this is going to turn out to be the point I'm trying to make to you is, I actually think this is going to turn out to be a broader question than the traditional definition of disabilities. And that it's going to go to include many more Americans. It's going to be a much bigger question.
Can I follow up with that, touching upon one of the things you talked about in your opening, which was incarceration? Mm-hmm. And what we're having a conversation in New Hampshire right now about bail reform and trying to break away from this decades-long habit of jailing people for homelessness, for substance use disorders, for mental health issues, for issues that aren't criminal-based, but because as a society we haven't come up with a better answer, we resort to jailing them. As a president, how would you make sure that issues of homelessness, mental health, substance use disorders are dealt with in a more productive way than through incarceration?
So, Jeannie's question is a deep one, and it's one that is actually really important. I think it really relates to Sarah's question too, in terms of what are we going to do? How are we going to treat people who have real issues and need support in our society? Homelessness, mental health, and the response, the traditional response of jailing people for those is a way of clearly not solving any problem other than to try to take the problem away and pretend it doesn't exist and basically put them in a box so that they're not being rehabilitated, they're not being supported, society's not being helped, we're just taking the problem and trying to hide it. Mm-hmm. So obviously that hasn't worked. And it's also true that from a mental health standpoint, we have got to get to the point of thinking mental health as health, that we're going to address it. And I think what we're seeing is so many of the thing of the issues in terms of the criminal justice system have been looked at in a way that isn't actually accurate or helpful. And this is a perfect example of it. That in fact, incarceration as an answer to homelessness is the wrong answer. Incarceration in response to mental health is often the wrong answer. And let me say this, I was in Iowa last week, I think, and they asked me, what system in Iowa provides by far the most mental health services? And the answer was the prison system, which if you think about it, doesn't make any sense at all. That in fact, the ability to deal with that, to deal with it effectively, and to actually help society and help those people, you do it in a completely different way. And I remember being in New Hampshire in 2014 when we were working, I was organizing for Jean Shaheen. And so I was having a conversation in Manchester with some business people. So we're talking about, you know, I built a business over 27 years. I started from scratch. I can talk business. So we're talking business, and I said, well, you guys, what's the biggest issue in New Hampshire? And they go, opioids. It's like, and it was like, okay. And then they went from having a nice conversation with Tom to a really serious conversation about what was going on in Manchester, New Hampshire. And one of the things they said to me was that in one of the towns in New Hampshire, they took half the enforcement budget away from the police and gave it to health people, professionals, to deal with opioids, and it improved everything. My only point being, the way we have this sense that somehow prison is the answer to everything, and it's not true. That in fact, we have to look at this in a completely different fashion. We have to step back from this command and control mentality and get back to the idea of how are we actually going to deal effectively with these problems.
So I really appreciate you acknowledging the problem. Can I push you on specifics on how we're going to solve it?
Which one are we talking about here?
On this, like you
homelessness, mental health.
Anyone, but I'm interested in your specific proposals for how to break the habit of trying to incarcerate our problem.
Well, look, homelessness. We have a huge homelessness issue in California, just so you guys know. 59,000 people living on the street in Los Angeles County. I mean, think about that. That's a gigantic number. I mean, one of the issues that makes we have 2 million too few housing units, at least in the state of California. 2 million too few units. And the most obvious way to see that and the most painful way is to see those people living on the street. But you see it in every single part of society, from young people who can't afford rent to living with their parents, to people commuting an hour and a half each way to work because they can't afford to live near work, to people who live in their cars, you know, and on and on. So when you think about that, that's a resource question. It's a government question. We didn't just build 2 million too few units. Those were political decisions by towns around the state of California about what they were going to do. And so in order for that to be undone, we're going to have to build a ton more units all up and down the spectrum. I think in terms of mental health, a lot of this has to do with resources, that we have to accept mental health is health. It should be treated on parity with other health issues, that it is much underappreciated and recognized. People are hesitant to even talk about it in many cases. But also then this is something that, if you'll excuse my saying so, Republicans love to cut. I was just talking to mental health professionals last week and in a Republican state, and honestly, what that administration, Republican governor, Republican state senate, Republican state legislature, was doing to the mental health facilities, to the workers in the mental health facilities, and to the patients, honestly, was one of the most astounding and awful things I've ever heard. An unwillingness to fund, treating the people working there abominably, but also cutting the ability of the state to respond to this issue. They've gone from like first in the country to 48th as a result of basic resource cuts. So a lot of this has to do with resource, focus, understanding approach.
I have a hunch. I think I know what this young person's question is, and I want to make sure we get it in.
Hello. My name's Corinne.
Corinne.
So as president, will you commit to rescinding every executive order related to the Muslim ban? And will you acknowledge it for what it is, not some travel ban, but a Muslim ban causing profound harm?
So, Corinne, the short answer is yes. And let me say this. Look, I live in California, and after the Muslim ban, one of the things that I wasn't running for president. I was organizing politically, so I had some freedom in my schedule, and one of the things that I did as much as possible was go talk to Muslim groups. And I went to talk, to hear, to do active listening, to hear from them what they what was happening in their lives and what it meant to them, what they wanted. I went to the airport when there was, remember there was a protest at the airport. I went to the airport like, and then I asked one of the groups, CARE. I was down in, I think, Los Angeles. And I said, so we did like an hour session about what was going on in their community and how their kids felt and what the ramifications were within the family. And I said, but I'm interested to know how you see the participation and reaction of other Americans. For instance, I went to the airport. Did you care? Did it matter to you that Americans went to the airport in effect to protest the Muslim ban in support of you and your community being treated as fully human, which is how I see this? And they said, which was actually interesting to me, they said, yes, it actually really matters to us that people support us and show that the attitude, you know, which this administration shows is different from most Americans, that there is fellow feeling, emotional support, and full acceptance. And really that's what this, you know, I think what Mr. Trump does, and he did with the Muslim ban, and he does with the wall, and all of these are attempts to vilify and isolate groups that don't support him and who his he can use to basically build his base, you know, emotionally. And so everything that, I'm entirely opposed to that. That whole idea that you would, I mean, when you think back in American history, when we have vilified, when the majority of people have vilified an out-group, it has led to horrible things, and it basically excuses horrible things and enables horrible things. So, I mean, that's why I pushed back then. And let me say this. You know, my dad was in the Navy in World War II, and he'd been to law school, for all you lawyers in the room. And so he became the assistant to the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg. He had high grades in law school, so they made him stay around an extra year and prosecute Nazis. And he always said, you don't know where this is going when you see this kind of evil in society, that it can go to places that no one contemplated when it started, that no one could extrapolate where it would go to, but it always gets worse, and it can go to places that you really can't imagine, you know, in a normal state of being. So yeah, I feel really strongly about this, by the way.
I'm gonna give you a really easy one.
Yes.
If you, well, I'm hoping for that answer. New Hampshire took a monumental step this year to ban the death penalty. And this issue has come up nationally in the last few days, and it's something that we've been asking candidates. We were the 21st state to abolish the death penalty. As president, would you abolish it nationally?
Okay, let me say this. I don't know exactly what it takes literally to abolish it. Am I in favor of abolishing the death penalty? Yes. Am I in favor of abolishing the death penalty nationally? Yes.
I'll take it. We'll work on the mechanics later.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Tess.
Tess.
And I wanted to sort of have you unpack a little bit more about healthcare as a right. And healthcare in the broadest sense. So in the spring, I hosted you at the Manchester Community Health Center. And the health center,
which I loved.
Yeah, thank you.
Which I don't know how many people know about it, but it's fantastic.
Well, thank you. We really are grateful for that. And the health centers so nationally serve 30 million people, and they provide these comprehensive services, so not just medical, but oral health and the mental health and substance use disorder, which, of course, we've just talked about is sort of a huge crisis for us. But they also think about the social determinants of health, and thinking about health as a broader sense. So making sure that you have food security, make sure that you have housing security. And so I wanted to know, as president, how would you sort of think about unpacking this whole issue of healthcare as a right and thinking about potentially building more capacity in the health centers so that we can see more patients for the substance use disorder and mental health, for oral health, for medical health, as well as think about, are people housed? Are they safe? You know, are they in lead abated houses? Do they have security in terms of food? So how would you go about doing that? And we would love your support for health centers nationally as well. So thank you.
So let me step back for 1 second to answer Tess's question. First of all, when I say I think every American has a right to health care, look, we're at a state, every other advanced country in the world gives health care as a right to their citizens. And I believe that it is impossible morally at this point, given how rich this country really is, to say that we're going to have people in this country we're going to turn away and not provide health care because they don't have insurance or they're not rich enough or whatever. I think that we're past that state. I don't think that I'm declaring it as a right. I think I'm recognizing a right that this country actually knows is true. And the only question is the one that you pose, which is, how do we do this in the most effective, cheapest way? Because we're paying way too much, because we're getting ripped off by a bunch of companies who are writing the laws in their own interest. And let me say one other thing about what Tess said. She's talking about a holistic approach to community health. And when I went and saw not just how effective her program is, but also how cost-effective, it blew my mind. And you know, you hear things traveling around the country. I actually have gotten to do this full-time for 7 years, go out and basically have sessions much like this. And I've, in spite of myself, learned a few things. And so when Tess was talking about oral health, one of the big reasons that kids miss school is their teeth hurt and they don't get to go to the dentist. And it seems like, oh, that can't be a big deal. It's a huge deal. Kids miss, that's probably one of the biggest reasons kids are truants. And if they get dental care, it actually changes their academic trajectory. The number of kids who don't have vision care so that they can actually see to read is shocking in the United States still. So when Tess is talking around about a wraparound service that provides on a community basis a series of what seem like unrelated services but are actually deeply related services at a really cost-effective way. The problem with Tess's program is she doesn't have drug companies supporting her. She doesn't have insurance companies supporting her. She doesn't have monopoly hospitals supporting her. They probably hate her for doing it so well. But it's actually incredible. I mean, honestly, when I went, I was blown away by the quality and sort of broad-based nature of the care that they were providing at a rate that was a fraction of what it happens in our normal healthcare society. So to me, what that says is, we have an ability to do this in an effective way that really changes people's lives much more than just filling prescriptions. And so actually, you know, people always ask me who I admire. And honestly, when you go around the country, you meet people just like this, who did this amazing job over a long period of time with amazing positive results just because they want to. So I think this woman honestly deserves a hand. If you guys, it's true. I'm telling you, what they're doing in these centers is amazing.
We're running out of time, so I'm going to ask one quick question related to New Hampshire.
Is it a yes or no?
Yes.
So this year, New Hampshire passed a law that adds a third gender marker to driver's licenses so that you can get an M, an F, or an X if you're gender non-binary. That's great, but in order to have truly consistent and accurate government ID, we need to extend that to passports, which is a federal issue. As president, would you support adding a third gender marker to federal ID?
Absolutely.
Is there a really quick question? Really quick. It's a yes or no?
Look, let me just say one thing. Can I just say one thing about this? It is really important that we as a society be much more aware and sensitive about sexual orientation and gender identity. And I think it is something which, once again, I think it's generational in terms of people's awareness and sensitivity, but the young people are definitely right. And we should definitely be bringing, I mean, this isn't a question to which there no is a possible answer. This is just the tip of an iceberg that is there. And honestly, many people may not be aware of it, but it's a huge issue. And giving the wrong answer to this is denying the humanity of millions and millions and millions of people.
Thank you for your position on that. My name's Josh. I'm a 1L here at the law school. And I understand that you've spent or will spend roughly about $50 million of your own money on this campaign. So my question is, how do you justify spending that on your own campaign when, to be completely honest, the writing is on the wall that you are not going to get this nomination? How do you justify spending that on your own campaign as opposed to donating it to someone like the ACLU or someone who will actually substantively protect civil liberties?
So let me come back with how many different ways I disagree with you. I hear you. First of all, I started one of the largest grassroots organizations in the United States, Next Gen America. We did the largest youth voter mobilization in American history last year. I'm still funding it. It's still going. I started a program that knocked on 15 million doors in 2016, 10 million doors last year, with seven national labor unions, knocking on the doors of sporadic Democratic voters called For Our Future. Still going, still supporting it. I started an impeachment effort against this president that got more than 8 million people to sign it. We're still pushing. I'm still supporting it. I can keep going in terms of the things I am doing, but I'm not stopping any of them. So whatever I do in terms of this campaign is not going to change the trajectory of any of the things that I've been doing for the last 10 years. But the last thing I'll say is this. I actually think you're wrong in terms of the election, and I'll tell you why. I'm not saying I will win, but I don't think anyone knows where this is going. This is much more in flux than you would think from reading the papers. If you actually look, people don't really focus on this until the end. If you look at how many people say they haven't made up their mind of Democratic primary voters, it's over 2/3. So in fact, I think the question is going to be that people are going to ask themselves, who can win? Who can actually keep the economy going? Because I know that's not what we're talking about in the Democratic primary, but ultimately people want to believe that this country will continue to be prosperous. And actually, when it comes to the economy, I've made some pitches about why I'm completely different from everybody else running. I'm the only person who's an outsider. I've done this successfully for 10 years. I think if you buy my argument, which I really think is right, that corporations have bought this system, I'm the person who fought them successfully for 10 years. But I also think if you ask who knows the most about the economy, look, I built a business from scratch internationally, from one room, no money, no windows, no employees, to a big multinational, multi-billion dollar business. So in answer to your question, I think the question is going to be, who do you trust to change this government? And I think that's very much an open question. So there's no part of your question that I agree with.
And I'll add one question. The question we will ask is, which candidate best protects civil liberties and civil rights? And we appreciate everybody coming today and helps as we pursue the answer to that question. We will be doing more of these events, so please keep notice. Follow us on social media if you don't already, and stay tuned. And everybody, please give Tom an extra hand for showing up tonight.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. And be sure to check out the video version of the podcast released every Thursday on UNHLA's Facebook page or YouTube.